Why is it that with sparkling water, I'm always playing guessing games with what flavor I'm drinking? Is it citrus? Is it aluminum can flavored? Not sure. Sparkling ice, though, they really mean flavor. Like, in-your-face flavor. Orange mango, black raspberry. Don't even get me started on the strawberry lemonade. Kiwi strawberry slid right into my taste buds' DMs last night and let them know who's boss. No subtleties there, and no sugar either. But it does have vitamins and antioxidants. Find sparkling ice at a major grocery store or club retailer near you. Sparkling ice. Anything but subtle.
What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello there. Welcome to today's New Books in Education, one of the podcast channels in New Books Network. This is your host, Pengfei Zhao, speaking to you from Gainesville, Florida. Today, I will be talking with Caroline Henrik, Jennifer Darlene Aduana, and Anna Lee Good on their new book, Equity and Equality in Digital Learning, Realizing the Promise in K-12 Education. Well, we all know the COVID-19 pandemic has profoundly changed the landscape of K-12 education in our society. Since last March, many states closed their physical schools and shifted to remote education. The massive shift is historic and unprecedented. Until now, well, we are hopefully seeing the light at the end of the tunnel in our battle against the coronavirus. Millions and millions of students are still learning at home via online learning platforms. It is also because of this shift that digital learning all of a sudden has drawn attention from not only educators, but also general public, from families to policymakers. Over the past months, we have seen concerted efforts to invest in digital learning and improve the required infrastructure. In spite of this unexpected, yet very much welcomed attention from the society at large, digital learning and teaching as a field has existed for a long time. Experts in this field have been documenting and exploring the best practice and required policy supports. Today, I am going to talk with three researchers who have been working in this field for a long time. Caroline Henrik from Vanderbilt University, Jennifer Darlene Aduana from the Georgia State University, and Anna Lynn Good from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. They just published their new book with Harvard Education Prize titled Equity and Equality in Digital Learning, Realizing the Promise in K-12 Education. The book systematically studies the implementation and best practice of using digital tools to reduce inequalities in educational opportunities and improve student outcomes. Although the book was out right before the start of the pandemic, the lessons, best practice, and insights they highlighted in their book have so much to offer for educators, policymakers, and families to navigate a teaching and a learning landscape during and after the pandemic. All right, now let's turn to Caroline, Jennifer, and Annalie. Hello, Caroline, Jennifer, and Annalie. Welcome to New Books in Education.
Thank you. So glad to be here.
Yeah, thank you for joining us. And also congratulations on publishing such a wonderful book. It's very informative.
Thanks. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, just to get us started, would you like to briefly introduce yourself to our audience?
Sure, I can go ahead and get started. This is Caroline Heinrich. I'm a professor of public policy education and economics at Vanderbilt University. And I've been studying, was previously at the University of Wisconsin, Madison, University of Texas at Austin, but started this work when I was at the University of Wisconsin, Madison many years ago with my colleague, Dr. Annalie Good.
Hello, my name is Jennifer Darlene Adwana. I'm an assistant professor at Georgia State University, and my focus is on the equity implications of online and virtual learning.
Welcome, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And welcome, Caroline and Annalie.
Thank you. I'm Annalie Good, and I am a researcher and evaluator at the Wisconsin Center for Education Research at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Well, thank you. And how did you come together to work on this project? We want to hear some of the behind-the-scenes stories first.
Sure. Well, I'll just continue. I can mention that Annalie and I first started working together at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and we started with working with one school district there in Wisconsin, Milwaukee Public Schools, and our interest in digital learning grew in part out of what we were seeing when we were studying out-of-school tutoring in various large-scale districts. And then I was at the University of Texas at Austin, and we expanded our partnership to Dallas Independent School District and other districts. And so also continued our focus on digital learning. And then I moved to Vanderbilt, and Jennifer was a PhD student at Vanderbilt University, and she joined in our study early on. And I think we were, as you mentioned, we were working on this research long before the pandemic. The roots of this specific study were in where we really honed in on looking at the implementation and impact of digital learning in about 2014. And so it's been a work that was developing over 5 years.
Well, that's really a long time commitment. And indeed, we would love to hear your thoughts about, you know, the pandemic, whether the pandemic is a game changer for your field or like any of the new stories. But, you know, before that, I just want to share that I'm also an educator and a researcher myself. So I even teach online courses for years, but before reading your book, I was not quite aware of how much coordinated and systemic efforts educators need to put in order to make, you know, quality digital learning for their students. So reading this book really changed my mind, my understanding on this issue. And I don't know, I mean, maybe we can get started with what is the book about, and even, you know, something like what is digital learning and how digital learning has been implemented in the American public schools.
So I'm going to say a little bit, and I'm going to hand off to my colleagues too. So one of the things we do in our book is we look at how digital learning is implemented at different levels. And so we're looking at, for example, when, you know, of course, we have some programs at the national level to encourage and support digital learning and the infrastructure, such as internet. And then states often make decisions about things. For example, you may have heard of states discussing one-to-one laptop initiatives for the states. And then local educational agencies also make decisions about, you know, what types of digital tools they want to bring onto their campuses. And then schools also have to make decisions about how to use leverage technologies, capacities for the ways in which their student bodies need them. And so we in our book, we look at each of these levels, decision-making about, you know, for example, like I said, what tools do you choose? How do you integrate them? all the way down to the classroom. And so we look at each of these levels and then dive deep into the classroom experience and even into the tools themselves, which Annalee and Jennifer have done a particularly interesting deep dive into recently.
So Jennifer and Annalee, would you like to chime in and share your thoughts on this?
Absolutely. I can talk about some of the deeper dives we've done into the curriculum. And so we started by looking sort of big picture at policy level implementation at the state, at the district, even at sort of the district or like school level. And we realized more and more just how much sort of these predominantly for-profit vendors were really shaping the educational experiences of students that were interacting with their programs. And so a lot of our more recent work has looked at what exactly the content is that's being taught, how instructors are, who are predominantly hired by the for-profit companies, are sort of shaping that experience and are or are not personalizing content for students. And so a lot of our ongoing work is looking at things like the level of authenticity. Are we actually able to encourage higher order thinking or real world relevance? And what does that look like in an online space? And then moving further into what does cultural relevance and responsivity look like online? And how can we create environments that are able to provide that on a larger scale, provide what we know to lead to higher quality instructional environments for students? And what that looks like when you're not just administering it through a school setting or with an individual teacher, but having to partner with and work with these larger technology-based companies to develop the resources to support that type of learning.
Well, thanks. Annalee, anything you would like to add?
Yeah, thank you. I was just going to add to the thinking about, like, we do think broadly about what digital tools are. So in thinking about that, it's on a school level, that can include actual hardware, so one-to-one devices, Padlets, tablets, or the software that's used to support instructional spaces that use digital tools. It's also the internet connectivity. So in thinking kind of broadly about what digital tools are, then thinking also about the different spaces pedagogically that lives in. So it can be the curriculum, it can be part of the instruction, it can be part of the assessment process. So I think one of the things that we appreciated about the opportunity to kind of go broadly and deeply into this work is to look at all these different ways that digital tools play out in a classroom. Because sometimes it changes day to day from a classroom, how the digital tools and which tools are going to be used and how different adults, typically adults in the space, but also the capacity of youth matter and how those tools are actually enacted and implemented.
Well, thank you for sharing this larger picture. I think this is very helpful. And I'm very curious to ask and to know more about, you know, before the pandemic, this may be a lot of the learning probably was happening in the classrooms. And now since last spring, since the start of the pandemic, a lot of the learning has been moved to, say, students' homes and maybe in a physically distancing classroom, or maybe even in a learning pouch. So what does that mean to digital learning?
So one of the things that because an advantage we had in our study, because we did look at study digital learning, as Annalee mentioned, a variety of tools over time, is we were actually able to see, for example, how the federal E-rate expenditures on improving the internet was changing the quality of the experience in the classroom for those using digital tools. So for example, one of the things we tracked in our study was looking at how time lost due to technology problems, like a lost internet connection or an inability of a student to log into their device or some other challenge. There's always, if you've ever taught with technology, no matter how much support you have on your campus, things go wrong, right? And so we had measured.
Yep. I'm as a parent, I kind of experience that on a day-to-day level.
Yeah, and we even experience it in the classroom in our own teaching. And so But one of the things we saw was in part due to some of those investments, and as well as, you know, districts learning over time to, you know, what it takes to support digital learning in the classroom and on campus, we saw things improving. So there was, you know, less time off task because of, you know, technology disruptions. And we had measured that, you know, that type of time was directly correlated with how students were learning with the technology and their outcomes. But what happened in the pandemic, of course, right? So all those improvements were kind of campus based, right? And then during the pandemic, as you mentioned, many children were learning from their homes. And so now you had circumstances all over again where the access to technology wasn't equitable. And we also saw, you know, for example, when we were doing our observations, our study, you know, was based on both classroom observations as well as large data analysis of actual micro interactions of students with technologies. We used both quantitative and qualitative methods. But what we had seen in our observations, for example, if someone was learning from home, let's say with an online tutor, if someone else in the home was also using the bandwidth or there was noise in the background or other, you know, activities happening, it was much harder for those students to concentrate and focus and to have, you know, consistent instructional time. So all those things that we were making improvements on over time, we saw you're kind of starting over when now you have students spread in. So you can think of homes as, you know, mini classrooms with differing access to technology and supports in the home, right? I mean, the other thing we learned from our study was how important instructor in the classroom was and instructor helpers to facilitating consistent use of technology for learning. And that's not guaranteed in the home either, that you're going to have people capable of assisting the students with the technology.
So I'm so curious about how this pandemic changed the whole field of your, like, of the digital learning field. Is it like a game changer, or is it still, have you been seeing some of the new manifestations of the old issues?
That's a great question. So I would argue that despite some notable differences, that a lot of the main findings of what we were seeing translate, they just might look a little bit differently. So like Carolyn was talking about sort of expanding infrastructure, we've seen that speed up at an incredibly faster pace, expanding broadband infrastructure, access to technology devices at homes, things like that. But those continue to be barriers and continue to be areas that we need to continue moving forward. The other thing that we saw through our work is that online and virtual and digital learning based courses work really well for some students sometimes. And I think that we're seeing that on an even larger scale right now, that because of the infrastructure investments that have already been made, I could imagine that virtual learning will continue at a larger scale. It might just be one course for a particular student. There might be more students opting into an entirely virtual learning experience, but there's going to be some students for whom this is a really powerful tool to meet their individual learning needs. Conversely, there are some students that aren't being well served by this model. And one of the things that we observed in our work with the two school districts we worked with was that sometimes allocating instruction for some students to a virtual space might allow the teacher to better meet the needs of other students face-to-face. So this can happen in a school setting. For instance, maybe some students are doing practice or enrichment activities online, and the teacher can work on remediation or other types of intervention with students who can really benefit from that face-to-face instruction. But we also saw this on the scale of like students being assigned to a fully online course, and that could reduce class sizes and allow the teacher to focus more on students who are in that face-to-face instructional environment in a way that they couldn't when they were serving maybe twice as many students. And so I think that the opportunity for virtual learning to be part of a bigger picture of personalizing students' learning experiences maybe has been made clear, and some of the infrastructure to implement that has been developed and invested in sooner because of COVID. But a lot of those same patterns we saw pre-COVID. And I think that once the pandemic era of crisis schooling has ended, we'll continue to see sort of on a larger scale moving forward.
So that's very interesting. And Jennifer, you just mentioned, like a moment ago, you mentioned this role of for-profit sector, private sector, the role they played in improving the infrastructure to implement digital learning. I wonder if you could say a little bit more about that, because I feel like their existence or their presence in this whole digital learning conversation is a little bit shadowy for the public. As we know, you know, the government, the state and federal government are making investment, and we know that educators and families, students are making efforts. But what is the role of, say, you know, the for-profit private sector in improving or in promoting digital learning prior to the pandemic and during the pandemic?
So that's a great question, and it's a huge, like, multi-billion dollar industry, and so it's hard to fully generalize, but I think it is important to note that often there was a for-profit industry in traditional face-to-face schooling that we all experienced growing up in, let's say, the textbook manufacturers, like what is put into a textbook and instructional guides or workbooks that might be provided to support that learning. But a lot of digital learning, in addition to selecting the content and providing instructional guides, is now also hiring and training and providing literal scripts in some cases to the instructors, if there are instructors, who are delivering the instruction itself. And so in a lot of ways, we're seeing sort of an incursion into the instructional core of schooling that we didn't see on that same scale in the past. And I think that that's something that isn't discussed a lot, but can have a large implication on students' learning experiences. And so definitely is something that through our work, we've tried to make people aware of and reflect upon the potential implications that can be used for good. It can be used to scale equitable learning practices, but it can also, if there is a lack of awareness about quality instructional practices or what equity in schooling looks like, can have a sort of oversized negative implication on students' learning experiences as well.
So if I understand this correctly, you are suggesting that the private sector's role could really be a double-edged sword in digital learning, in students' learning and teachers' teaching. What are some of the examples, like concrete examples? Can you give us some of the examples? Oh, I don't know. I mean, which one of you would like to take the question?
Sure. I mean, we can talk about that. And Anna Lee, I know, has written on this, wrote on this issue more broadly too. And I'm sure she will want to chime in a little bit. But I mean, so, you know, it's the private sector, as Jennifer was saying, has long had a role in developing content, right, for students to use, whether it's textbooks. And, you know, when you go to digital form, right, it's sometimes content, as Jennifer was describing, plus the tool, right? And so, you know, one of the things that we learned through our study is that, you know, when technology developers create a particular type of tool, whether it's a tablet with embedded, applications or platforms that can access applications, or it's a, you know, other kind of one-to-one device or an online instructional program, like Jennifer was describing too, you know, they make assumptions about, you know, students' capabilities for interacting with those tools and about where they are, let's say, on grade level. And the reality is, especially we were studying, you know, large urban school districts, is that students at a given grade level may be all over the place in terms of their ability to use those tools. And so one of the things that we have come to understood is, and one of the things we talk about in our book, is that, you know, this is a really big market for technology, for developers of digital technology for use in education, but districts can advocate for those technology developers and vendors to be more supportive and active and actually making sure those tools are used in ways that allow, for example, personalization of instruction at the right level or modifications for students with disabilities, or, you know, adequate supports for teachers so that teachers can understand how to use those tools well, to make those kinds of adjustments in the classroom or for a given student on the platform so that they can learn well. And I think what we've come to understand is sometimes, you know, those tools are sold with a lot of promise, but it takes a whole lot more effort to actually deliver quality instruction and equitable access to instruction than comes with any, you know, training that is with the tools. So, you know, part of what we've seen with our school district partners, what we've encouraged is that, you know, they work with the technology vendors and developers and curricula and everything to consider how they can be, you know, more effectively used to really, if we all share this common goal that we want children to maximize what they can learn in their time spent interacting with them.
Yeah, thank you. And it's such an interesting topic. I really appreciate you digging in a little bit on this, because I think one of the things I think about is that what the digital space does in the conversation around the privatization in education is, and both Jennifer and Carolyn touched on this, is the scale that it provides. And so we saw this in a couple different examples of the different contexts in which we were studying. So one in particular is the use of private entities to provide tutoring to individual students. And having that tutoring happen on a digital platform provided a scale to those private entities that the in-person tutoring companies and organizations could not compete with, literally could not compete with. And so in the marketplace of public money going to private entities to provide tutoring, the digital providers took over because they could scale, and not only scale across a district, but scale across the country. And then some of the approaches, some of the platforms, they could also standardize in ways that then again scale out the reach of it versus the cost of producing it, which is very different. I mean, one-to-one instructional experiences for students are really expensive. That's in-person. In-person one-to-one is very expensive. When that changes to remote, that changes the scale, that changes the, economic terms, like the efficiencies of it. So I think that that's a really important piece here. And certainly, I mean, in the COVID context, we've seen what happens in the market of privatized services and goods. I think another important piece here is when instruction is digital and when curriculum is digital, it impacts the extent to which there's transparency around it. And so you can imagine, we've had this in a couple of the different areas that we've studied too, where in some cases, really the only stakeholder, the only person who really knows what that product is the student, because they're in the instructional space more than the teacher is, because the teacher's got 30 students / 150 students. How can they be in every single little instructional interaction that is created and then managed by a private entity? And so the outsourcing, I mean, that's a strong word to use, but the transparency of it hasn't caught up. And so that's part of, you know, Jennifer mentioned one of the things that we're started to do and are excited about doing is looking more deeply into those actual curriculum and instructional spaces that oftentimes it's just the student who's interacting with. And the last thing I'll say is, you know, K-12 education has always partnered with private entities, whether it's the busing company, and Jennifer mentioned this early, you know, the busing company is usually a private entity. There's probably no space in the United States where there's going to be only public K-12 schooling. It depends on these partnerships with private entities. So that said, there are also things I think the COVID context has laid bare around that relationship of what should be privatized and what should remain public. And I really want to highlight the importance of internet connectivity and the quality of internet connectivity to making this work or not. And I think the discussion that's been renewed in the context of COVID around the internet as a public good has been really interesting. And I think really important is that, look, this isn't going to work. If public education is going to be as virtual as we think it's probably going to be going forward, it's not going to work unless there's equitable access to internet. And chances are then that means it's going to have to be a public good versus privatized.
Well, that really helps to contextualize what's going on here. And I think, as you all mentioned, this partnership between the public sector and the public education, public schools and the private sector here is so new. I mean, it's very, very new for just the parents, families, students, I believe maybe for teachers and educators as well. So there is this sense of like, what's going on there? And all of a sudden we all have to, you know, help our kids get on the computer or help our kids get on the iPad to talk with their teachers. And it sounds like it's such a meaningful project and meaningful investigation that you are doing just to, you know, giving us more, like offering more insights on this and like what's going on with this new popularization maybe of digital learning. And I wonder if you could say a little bit more about this conversation about internet connectivity as public good as well. So I've also noticed that there are quite some conversations on this, on the say pretty big influential news media platform. And I wonder, so what are some of the rationale of why there was this revival of the conversation in the pandemic?
I think that goes back to my earlier comment that, you know, we had been responsive in terms of public policy had been responsive in terms of making sure that campuses had access to faster internet speed. And so we made really big gains in the last, you know, I'd say, you know, 5 years or so in the number of, I think we went to 99% of schools having access to high-speed internet access. And that makes a big difference when you have students using digital, you know, tools of various types, whether it's, you know, laptops or online instruction or tablets and things like that. So we did make all that progress on campuses, but when you're talking about home becoming the new learning space, then you have to think about not just, you know, institutions, schools, but everyone having access. And that's a much bigger, you know, challenge. You know, for example, we've long known that it's been more difficult in rural areas to get, you know, high-speed internet access. And that's where I think you're seeing now more policy attention to that. I know in our own state, Tennessee, our governor is announced investments in that. And, you know, and so there may, for example, if you have been in a rural area, there may be some options, but they may be very expensive and they may be not very high speed. And so you just don't have the scale there driving, you know, the private providers into, you know, networking everybody. But so that has come, I mean, there definitely have been public investments over time as well, in just generally expanding internet access. But obviously we learned through this pandemic when we had to make it possible for everybody to learn online, at least initially, you know, many schools for some time, whether it was some maybe only a few weeks, but everybody had to figure it out. And that's where we learned how far we have to go yet. But that's a bigger kind of public infrastructure question that is, you know, not necessarily just an educational question, because it also affects families' access to, you know, other types of services, public services, that where we've gone to having digital applications or things like that. So it's a bigger question that goes beyond education.
Totally. I mean, I've seen people arguing for the internet, the free public internet access, as a way to, you know, support people's civil rights, for example.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Why is it that with sparkling water, I'm always playing guessing games with what flavor I'm drinking? Is it citrus? Is it aluminum can flavored? Not sure. Sparkling ice, though, they really mean flavor. Like in-your-face flavor. Orange mango, black raspberry. Don't even get me started on the strawberry lemonade. Kiwi strawberry slid right into my taste buds' DMs last night and let them know who's boss. No subtleties there, and no sugar either. But it does have vitamins and antioxidants. Find sparkling ice at a major grocery store or club retailer near you. Sparkling ice. Anything but subtle.
And I wonder, like, I mean, we've covered this part about the role of the private sector, which is very interesting, which is sort of like shadowy, in my opinion, as a more like an educated general public. But I wonder, what are some of the, what is the role of the school district? Are they the major decision makers in terms of how those digital learning programs are implemented in schools?
Well, I'll just give one example of this. So when we first started working with Dallas Independent School District, there was a school board decision that said, you know, we will go with a one-to-one laptop initiative. And so suddenly the schools were trying to figure out how they were going to make that happen. And it was supposed to be district-wide, and they started trying to roll it out. And that's when they realized how many challenges there were. So I think this is one of the things that we've talked about in our work. We have a research brief on this, is the actual purchase of the tools is the cheapest part of probably the quickest and easiest decision that they often make without thinking about all that has to happen with, you know, handing out devices to make sure they're used well for learning and instruction. And so, you know, that was one of the things we learned when we first started working with Dallas, is how challenging that was. And I could, you know, everything from just the logistics to getting the laptops the right place, decisions about whether kids should be able to take them home or not, age and grade appropriate content and types of access to content on laptops. And I can tell you that initiative did not fully roll out. They made some changes, and they ended up working with a foundation partner to actually, they needed that support. The support didn't come from the school board or the district for them to integrate it. They partnered with a local nonprofit foundation that actually helped not only fund costs of devices, but also provided an incredible amount of support to the district in training teachers and seeing how they're used in the classroom, providing models for instruction and training that didn't happen just on, oh, how do you unlock this device and hand it out, but on what is, you know, a good integration and of whatever type of device it is in the classroom learning for that grade. And so that was one of the things we studied in our observations. And we've worked closely with Dallas and with the foundation partner to try and understand, you know, what was working and what was not working in the different strategies they were trying to integrate those tools well. But I think that's one of the things we saw is people think that, oh, the biggest decision is about buying the device. And actually there's so much more that follows that takes so much more work. And sometimes it's often the case that the people who end up, you know, in the classroom implementing it had little to no role in what technology would be integrated when and how. And yet they are, you know, charged with implementing it. So that's one of the things, you know, we document in our book is the different roles that instructors play, how they can be supported, different strategies they used. And so really what we try to do in the book is share and show those things, you know, both what worked and what didn't work to help others who find themselves in this situation where suddenly they're implementing an initiative that they didn't necessarily create or you know, weren't able to have input and thinking through how it would work in the classroom or outside the classroom if you're doing it in a, you know, working with your kids in a different location.
You did. There are, I mean, I could only imagine how much effort these school districts have to put into in order to make this workable or feasible for families to do this during the pandemic. You I've seen, you know, in my kid's school, for example, like once, like every a few weeks, there will be this conversation about technology and anybody, any family needs the computer, for example, from the school, and they will have this pickup. This is just like one opportunity for the parents to really glimpse at some of the efforts that school districts have been making to make this work. And I just wonder, you know, like, what was the transition? What did the transition look like? Because there was this big shift last spring from implementing all of these programs in classrooms to outside the classrooms. Maybe within 2 weeks, a lot of schools need to make this transition, but do you have any insights or any stories that you could offer us about on this end?
So I think there's a lot of really important ways to answer that question, but sort of building upon that really rich example that Carolyn presented, I think one of the takeaways for a pandemic and post-pandemic world of our book is that we followed this long-term relationship over 10, 15 years with two districts who, in a lot of ways, were early adopters of digital learning. And for that reason, they experienced a lot of pitfalls and a lot of challenges. And we, as a research practice partnership team, worked together to identify what those challenges were and to figure out the best way to sort of work through those solutions. And so our goal in writing this book was that not every school district, not every teacher, not every parent or student needs to start at that sort of ground level and experience all of those same challenges, that we wanted to share that journey of how you work over time to implement a solid program so that other schools can start at sort of a higher level. With that said, we want to acknowledge that emergency virtual schooling that was happening because of sort of this crisis-driven rapid shift is in no one's idea of what an ideal learning situation should look like. But over time, as we continue to refine and improve and integrate virtual learning as part of sort of this larger idea of the K-12 education system, I think that there's a lot of opportunity to pull from these longer term experiences of the two districts we worked with, along with all of the more recent experience that school districts across the country are gaining through COVID era schooling.
Thanks, Jennifer. Yeah, I think it's very interesting to see how the development of the digital learning evolved over the past several years, as you mentioned, and you have been following these two pioneer school districts for almost a decade. And so what are some of the examples about, you know, I think two of the keywords in the book is one is equity, one is quality. I wonder what are some of the examples of promoting, say, equity in digital learning, let's say, if we envision a post-pandemic world, what are some of the takeaway points we could draw from the book to promote equity in digital learning?
So I'll just quickly give an example, and I know I'm sure Annalee and Jennifer might have one as well, there needs to be, you know, there is usually an adult responsible in terms of the instructor. Now, again, in the pandemic, parents have had to help out at home, but the students are are, you know, depend on the ability to have an adult who can, for example, engage with them and assist with content learning. So even if the content is delivered, as kind of Jennifer was describing, sometimes these curriculums are built into the tools, there will still be times when those students need support, assistance, customization, help outside of the tool to deepen and move their understanding. As I mentioned, you know, not everybody in grade level is consuming the content at the same level. And so we need to, that the person who plays the role in, whether it's in a classroom or in online communications with a student, it is really important for those instructors to understand, you know, what their students' needs are. And, you know, I, you know, have been in classrooms and observed very different approaches. Some instructors who are very aware and attentive and work very hard to help those students who need, for example, additional supports, maybe outside of the learning they do with the digital tool. And I've also seen, you know, examples where those students are in front of a digital tool or using digital tool and struggling on their own for the entire class period and never get that kind of assistance. And so, of course, like we mentioned, the challenge in the pandemic is when kids aren't in the classroom, someone still needs to understand where they are. And that's a really important, I think, equity issue, you know, making sure all students have equitable access to those kinds of supports.
Yeah, so I really appreciate that description because I think it gets at a lot of the nuances of what do we mean when we say equity. And I think that there's, we tried in the book to think about equity around access and opportunity, and then also outcomes, and especially the work that Carolyn and Jennifer did to look in really, you know, I think creative and innovative ways at how to look at outcomes, not only at in the moment, and not only within the types of measures that are available within a district, but then linking it to measures that are, you know, pulling on data that are collected with the private partners, and then looking at it longitudinally as well over time, because I think a really critical part of thinking about equity is thinking about, again, equitable access, opportunities, and outcomes, but also thinking about systems and thinking about justice within those systems. For it to be equity focused, it needs to be justice focused. And that I really appreciate the way that Carolyn and Jennifer think about looking at outcomes, because it's towards understanding these systems level impacts of something like digital learning. So for example, not only looking at, you know, credit recovery in the moment for that 11th grader that just took algebra, but also looking at graduation rates, also looking at post-secondary attainment, and eventually also looking at where do those patterns play out in the workforce. So, and these are systems level questions that have implications then for what are we expecting of virtual learning? What are we expecting of digital learning in the role that we think education is supposed to play? So I want to highlight that. And I really, again, appreciate that being part of a mixed methods team where the quantitative approach to understanding outcomes is nuanced and is equity focused.
So that really helped me to understand how you approach the issues here about equity. I mean, if we think we sort of like break it down to access, opportunity, and achievements, for example, and that really helps. What about quality?
So I think in thinking about both equity and quality, moving beyond sort of traditional definitions, which are very important, and we did look at, one thing that really emerged over and over and over again in our work was sort of the importance of acknowledging and recognizing and integrating students' humanity. And that's something that we know, whether it's a traditional face-to-face setting or a virtual setting, is important. Learning is socially and culturally situated. Students who have a sense of belonging and can develop identities as learners do better in school. They have better intrinsic motivation, all of that. We absolutely know is important person in a face-to-face setting as well. But technology often has a tendency to be a little bit more sterile. Different elements of interactivity can be more challenging to sort of implement on scale. Sometimes, although not always, they're replacing or removing the sort of instructor or opportunities for peer collaboration. And so I think that as we were looking at evaluating what makes a really an equitable and a quality digital tool, that those conversations need to be had. It's sort of implicit often that those are things that you want in a traditional face-to-face classroom. But if they're not being discussed about when you're selecting digital tools, it might lead to something that's missing some of those really important personal and humanizing aspects of a traditional face-to-face classroom.
So that's a very important point. As I understand about this humanizing part, and also I think that it seems that on the one hand we need to pay attention to these systemic issues, and by looking at that we kind of need to use the numbers. For example, we need to look at the large scale data set, but then the humanizing part and the part of supporting instructors and families and students, and also, including their voice in your study. I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about that.
I want to mention one other aspect of how we looked at quality. And I think it's, so one of the things I mentioned we did was we did hundreds and hundreds of observations across our study districts. And the observation instrument we used was based on what we knew about, quality instructional practices. And so in a prior study, we had developed an observation instrument looking at tutoring, then we adapted that instrument for the digital setting. But, in addition to things like, looking at the actual content, and Jennifer mentioned some aspects of content in our discussion today already that we were interested in, but also looking at how the instructor and student are interacting. So the instructor's engagement, the student's engagement, as well as their interactions between instructor and the digital tool and the student. Also students, what we called, how responsible the student was using the tool as well, in terms of, were they using it for the appropriate things? One of the things we learned is that students, given a tool with lots of capacities, can sometimes use it for things that, weren't intended to be part of the learning process. And so we did have an observation stream, which we documented over many, many observations. And we were able to look at, patterns in student use and, what we were documenting in the classrooms. And that was a real fascinating aspect of it. And I think, the human part of it comes in there too, right? Because like we were mentioning, how engaged the instructor is with the students in there, how engaged the student is. And that depends on how the tool is being used, how it's integrated in the classroom. I mean, if you just stick a student in front of a computer and let the computer drive the instruction, you can imagine how long they're going to stay engaged versus, other ways that we saw sometimes instructors using really, we saw wonderful exemplars of instructors having students learn with each other using the tool, integrating games as way of learning, and also having, a mix of whole, whole group learning and part, peer-to-peer learning, and, a mix of both the tool and other classroom activities. So there are lots of ways that, the instructional quality can be really exceptional. And then we saw plenty of ways in which it, without those kinds of supports and engagement and strategies employed, it could be a not at all engaging process for students, no matter how many capacities the tool has.
Well, so that's very helpful in understanding this engagement and the instructors and the students' role in this whole picture. And it seems that, it attests to really how much it is needed for us to have not only a big picture, a systemic understanding of this very new digital learning, but also we need to zoom in to look at how it works really for students and families. And I could imagine, you know, for a book like this, offering this very comprehensive picture of the field, it must have like different types of audience. So I wonder if you could say a little bit more about what are or who are the intended audience of your book, and what are some of the best ways to use the book?
Sure, I can talk a little bit about that. That I appreciate how you framed that question. So we hope that everyone would find this book useful and interesting. We really did try to think about different levels of implementation and implementors and practitioners in this. And really, when we were writing the book, talked a lot about kind of the zooming in, zooming out of the classroom level, and then the district level, and then the state policy level, and hoping that there are insights coming out of the book and patterns that come out of the book and really literally recommendations coming out of the book along those different levels. We really do hope that educators, policymakers, decision makers along all those levels see parts of themselves in the book and that can see ways that they can inform the work that they do out of the book. So the audience, we did want to write it in a way that people could come in and out of parts of the book and be useful, but also that there's an arc to it and that it tells a story throughout, you know, throughout lots of different case examples and lots of different types of thinking about data and thinking about interaction with digital tools. And we do, you know, throughout the process and then after the process, we've really also tried to create additional pieces or products out of the book as well, really trying to work on blogs or op-eds or, you know, pieces that will get elements of the book out to different audiences. Because again, back to that equity question, you know, it's about informing practice, it's about changing practice, but it's also about hopefully impacting the systems around that either constrain or facilitate the kind of practices that we would like to see or the kinds of access that we would like to see. So we really do hope that there is a policy and a systems level audience for this as well.
Anything you'd like to add, Jennifer and Caroline?
Annalie sort of said this, but I can make sure it's stated explicitly that our editor was incredibly helpful at guiding us to make sort of each chapter so it could stand on its own and it could speak to a specific audience. And so one chapter is focusing on these policy level decisions and sort of leverage points. Another one focuses on more school level decisions or teacher level decisions or like looking specifically at the student outcomes and experiences. And so while we would hope that you would be interested enough to read the entire book, it also, you can pull out chapters that might be most relevant to you and sort of dive in there. And they were meant to be self-explanatory and that context is explained in each of those places. So that if you need a quick guide in a particular area that you're focusing on right now, you can sort of zoom into that chapter as well as reading the book more holistically from beginning to end.
Yeah, and I would just add that we did try to include, you know, many examples of what we saw in our work, our observations in classrooms, from our interviews with teachers. And so I think sometimes it's helpful for, you know, teachers to see, you know, what did that exemplar look like of a teacher using a digital tool really well, or, you know, what were some, you know, things, you know, strategies that we saw, you know, instructors developing over time or those working to help support the technology integration. What kind of strategies did they develop? You know, a simple one like, you know, sometimes having a student technology helper in the classroom can make a big difference when you run into those technology glitches. Someone can go around and help and look at devices, not to mention it, you know, makes those students feel really good about their role. So we also tried to make sure the book is sprinkled with things that would pique people's interest in terms of, and maybe even see themselves in those roles as they're reading.
That's super cool. I hope, you know, I don't know who our audience are, but I hope our audience can really pick up the book and see themselves from the chapters, and that can really shift their thinking, the way how digital learning is implemented in this country. So that has been very interesting and helpful to have this conversation with all of you. And as we sort of like wrap up our conversation, I would like to ask what you are doing right now. What's your current project? Are you still collaborating or you have your own individual project taking off?
So yes, we are absolutely still collaborating both amongst ourselves and with the school districts that we've built these partnerships with. They are ongoing. And as we've sort of hinted to along the way, we've been focusing more and more on the sort of direct student interactions with content and also the sort of humanizing aspect. And so our current work is partnering with not just school districts, but now also now involving some of the online course vendors in the case of the project we're working on to not just evaluate what it looks like once students are exposed to it, but sort of go back a little bit and redesign what that online content looks like. How can you make it more culturally relevant? How can you make it more equitable in the design phase? And then working with students to refine and get feedback and really create a new model for what a online learning environment and course can look like, figuring out what sort of training needs to be provided to in-district teachers to support that type of learning. And so really trying to reimagine and redevelop a more equitable model for fully online course taking at the high school level. So we are really excited about the opportunity for this partnership and hopeful that this will continue to sort of move the needle on what online learning looks like.
That's fantastic. Carolyn and Annalie, would you like to add something here?
No, I think Jennifer described it exactly. So thank you.
Cool.
Yeah, I would just say that, you know, obviously one of the things that a lot of policymakers, I've had conversations recently with people at the U.S. Department of Education and then our own state policymakers have also been looking at this. You know, everybody's very concerned about learning loss and, you know, how through the pandemic, how that will be made up. And so interestingly, they're coming back to thinking about things like tutoring, which is, you know, where we started in our study, looking at out of school tutoring and how that was done online versus in person. And so we're kind of recircling back to, you know, what have we learned over time from implementing you know, ways to help students with extra academic assistance to catch up. And I have no doubt that, you know, online is going to continue to be a platform in which we do this. And we're hoping that we can learn from the years that we've been studying this. And that goes back to 2006 when we first started studying the tutoring and the various ways it's delivered. And so we hope that we can learn from the research evidence. We think that there is a lot to say about, you know, what are some guidelines, what are some parameters, and really important that I think we should also share and is included in our book is we did develop, you know, instrumentation. As I mentioned, we mentioned our observation instrument. We also developed like a short walkthrough instrument for, you know, whether you're a school leader or someone else involved in implementation to get an understanding of how technology is being used in your learning environments. And we really think it's important for monitoring to happen, for people to care and understand and watch, you know, how learning is taking place. And so we think that, you know, there are tools out there now, there's a research base that we can learn from. And I really hope that as we move forward with concrete initiatives to address the learning loss from the pandemic, that we keep all these lessons in mind, and we hope that, you know, we can continue to be a resource for others who are contemplating, you know, which direction those policies should move. We know we're in a resource-constrained environment as well, and so we have to make, you know, good decisions, and so hopefully that's what we'll be doing going forward.
Definitely. Is this a book project or is this more like an applied project?
I mean, that is what I was just talking about now is essentially an evidence base that we've been developing, like I said, over more than a decade. And so we do have a website.
Cool.
We have a website for our study that as we have created links to that in the book and our materials. And then Annalie, I was also sharing with the U.S. Department of Education, our website from our Study of Supplemental Educational Services Implementation Impact, which is still based at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And so We try to make those materials available. We have numerous, publications are still coming out from our study. Jennifer and I had one come out this week. They're still coming out, and we are posting them and making them available. So yeah, so I think it's not necessarily a new book project, but continuing work. And we've also created, for example, research briefs and things that help to distill, kind of key lessons for different groups like policymakers and parents and others.
It sounds super cool. And we will have an opportunity to invite all of you back to New Books in Education again and to talk about the new findings, the new insights that you would like to offer to our public and to our educators and families and students. Well, with that said, thank you all for joining me today. And it has been a pleasure to talk with all of you. And thank you for sharing your wonderful work with us.
Thank you for inviting us. It was our pleasure.
Yes, thank you so much.
Bye-bye.